November 29th. Sunny and seasonal, today's high 43. Overnight, cloudy, 30% chance of light rain, tonight's low 35. Thursday, sunny and breezy with a high of 49. Right now, wind from the north at 5. Sunshine, blue skies, a little chilly. 30 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm pleased to welcome back into our studios Lisa Konetsky, who is on the theater faculty, professor of theater. Is that what you call it at Parkside?
Yes, that's theater arts.
Professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Lisa Konetsky goes back on the morning show quite a long time.
I'm old.
We're both old. What would you guess would have been roughly the years of our first conversations from your first tenure at UW Parkside? I mean, when did you begin teaching there?
1985.
Wow. I started here in 1986, and my recollection is that you are among the very first guests that I ever had on the morning show back when I was only doing this part-time.
Well, and I remember the old building coming here, and yeah, I mean, a lot of interviews over the year.
Absolutely.
All of which I've enjoyed.
Yes, me too. Absolutely. So this is a span of 30 years, although a little interruption in the middle when you left Parkside for some position in Madison and then came back to Parkside and are back to the business of directing great plays. And a great play is about to open at Parkside with performances this weekend and the next. And it's so interesting how this play stands in stark contradistinction to just about everything else that's going on this weekend, from the Messiah at Parkside to a Christmas festival at Carthage to a Christmas carol at the Racine Theater Guild to the Lessons and Carols, the Choral Arts Society. And then in the midst of all of that holiday beauty and fun, this stark Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Tony Kushner called Angels in America. At the time that this was chosen, and I assume you had a hand in choosing to do this play and to do it at this point in the calendar, how much did you think about that in terms of the stark contrast that this play represents amidst everything else going on right now?
Yeah, we thought about it a lot, and we went back and forth about whether to do it as the first show of our season so that people wouldn't be confused by that title, Angels in America, and think, oh, this is a Christmas show, because it is not a Christmas show. So that's an important thing for your listeners to know.
If they remember nothing else from this interview.
Don't come expecting Christmas angels, because that's not what you're going to get. But I think for us, we were really looking at a lot of complexities in our calendar, casting decisions, rehearsal schedules, and this was just the right slot for this show. So we were hoping and are hoping that our advertising lets people know that this is a serious play, although it is very funny in parts, and not the traditional Christmas fare. And for some people, that can be a nice thing. You know, there's a lot of choice of things to do, but sometimes it's nice to do something that is a little out of the annual calendar of what people do.
Well, absolutely. And I know plenty of people, in some ways I'm one of them, that sort of resent being rushed into Christmas or whatever holiday that you celebrate at this this time of the year. And I mean, even for like a good Lutheran like me, we have the season of Advent that's so supposed to precede Christmas, and yet all around us is Rudolph and Santa and everything else.
Started at Halloween, right?
Absolutely. So anyway, so I for one actually welcome the idea of there being something else. For as much as I love all the other things that are going on right now, there is something to be said for giving us something that is not what we naturally think of at this time of year. This is a complicated play to talk about.
Extremely complicated.
Let's begin with the man responsible for it, a very, very gifted writer by the name of Tony Kushner. Just tell us a little bit about him and what he has done even apart from this great play.
Tony Kushner is really, I think, an amazing playwright and just an amazing public intellectual, a really smart, smart man who is very interested in commenting on the United States, our culture, the major forces that drive us politically, socially, in terms of race, in terms of all kinds of issues that have sort of conflated in the period of time that we live in. So just a really smart man. He's written a number of plays, although Angels in America, which is in two parts, is certainly the one he is most well known for. He is a very active playwright. He's also someone who, I'm just thinking that about 5 or 6 years ago, we took students to see a musical that he had written called Caroline or Changed. So a really wonderful show. It was in Chicago, and it had been running for a couple of weeks, and there sitting in the audience was Tony Kushner.
Wow.
Seeing his show. And when I saw Angels in America on Broadway, standing in the back of the theater, there was Tony Kushner watching his show. So he's somebody who writes and rewrites and comes back and comments and really engages in the complexity of thinking about and writing about the world that we live in.
Hmm. And I have to say that he is the screenwriter for two of the best films in recent years, Munich and especially Lincoln.
Lincoln
is an amazing film. And he deserves a great deal of credit, and I think was maybe nominated for an Oscar for that screenplay. And I wonder, it got me thinking about what the difference is between being a playwright and a screenwriter, and how different those two crafts are from one another.
Very different from one another, although I'm probably not the best person to speak to that. I think, you know, when I think of playwriting, I really think of the importance of economy, that you're telling a story in a short period of time, and everything that's in there has to have a very direct purpose. Because you're really telling the story through language in a way that is expanded with film, where you have so much more that you can do in terms of camera work and locations and visuals. Not to say that theater doesn't do a lot in terms of visual representation. But I think film is, it allows you a certain freedom that the theater doesn't have. But a good writer is a good writer. And Kushner has a tremendous ear for language and for the way characters speak and the differences between the ways that characters speak. And when I think of Lincoln and Munich, I think of both as, you know, political plays, and Kushner is very much a political playwright, that are really, again, commenting on certain period historical periods and how they impact both individuals and society as a whole.
We're speaking with Lisa Kornetsky, who is from the Theater Arts Department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and she is director of their next production that opens this weekend, and that production is of Angels in America. I guess the full title of it I'm seeing is Angels in America, A Gay Fantasia on National Themes. Parkside is doing the first of two parts of this play called Millennium Approaches, and I guess this play, when done in its entirety, I mean, scarcely can be done in a single evening. It's that lengthy.
No, it can't. And in fact, just a little bit about the history of the play. When Kushner wrote this play, he wrote it in a workshop setting and wrote it fairly quickly. And when one of his colleagues or collaborators read the play, they said, this is really two plays, Tony, because it was over 6 hours long. So he worked on it and divided it into two pieces. And most of the time, people often do just part one. I think the play is certainly more complete when we see it in two parts. But most of the time when it's done in two parts, it is done on consecutive evenings. So, for instance, the play, when it opened on Broadway, Millennium Approaches, ran for about 9 months, and then Perestroika, which is part two of the play, opened, and you could see them in rep. So when I saw them in New York, I saw the first one, came back the second night to see the second one. And there's a new production opening. There was an award-winning production at the National Theatre in London last year, with Nathan Lane playing a major character, and I'm trying to remember his name, Garfield, who was in Hacksaw Ridge. I'm forgetting his first name. Andrew Garfield, playing a major character. And that is moving to Broadway for an 18-week run, late winter, early spring. And I just went to look at tickets, and it's the same thing. You buy for two nights in a row. I don't think they even allow you to buy one without the other at this point, at least online. So often they run that way. But it's important to note that both plays are about 3 hours long each individually.
And so part one, which you're doing, Millennium Approaches, premiered in 1991. And I was actually a little surprised to read that, because this play is really set in the mid-'80s at the height of the AIDS crisis.
Right.
And in my mind, more years had elapsed before Tony Kushner sat down to write a play that reflected on that moment in our history. And in a sense, that history wasn't even history yet. It was still very much a part of the current landscape when he wrote this.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that, and something, you know, that we've talked a lot about in our rehearsal process, is that AIDS for the general public was something that was, you know, the press, the government, the public were slow to catch on to what was really happening with the AIDS crisis. But the gay community, particularly in New York, where this play takes place, and in San Francisco, were very aware of what was happening. You know, there's certainly a lot of movies and plays and documentation of how slow we were as a country to sort of latch on to the need for providing services, doing research, going from thinking of it as a gay plague to something that obviously impacted people in all segments of our population. So I think by 1991, when he was writing this, and 1993, when it was presented, there, you know, history was sort of contracted at that time. An awful lot had happened. But I think it's important that he chooses 1985, because it's kind of a, as you said, it's the height of the disease. People are really, at this point, dying in droves. It is still a death sentence, AIDS, at this point. It, you know, we have AZT, but the side effects are tremendous. It's almost impossible to get. Very different than the way we think of AIDS now. And I always find it, having lived through that period and having had friends who have died of AIDS, it is so much a part of, you know, my growing up, I guess. It's interesting to work with students who think of AIDS in a completely different way, because really there are so many people who are living successfully with AIDS
today.
But in 1985, that was not the case.
Right. I saw very recently on Facebook, actually, a very stark representation of that. It was apparently a recent performance of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And I believe it was that ensemble. And they were dressed, I believe most of them were dressed in all black, but then there were a few isolated figures who were dressed in white. And those gentlemen are the only survivors.
From the original?
Right. And it was just a very stark visual representation of just how that community was decimated over the years.
Decimated. And Kushner is himself an openly gay man. He's writing from that perspective. And he does a wonderful job, I think, of integrating the disease and all of its implications into the play. But it is certainly not a play. If one were to say, what is this play about? It's about many things, AIDS being one piece that connects several of the characters, but that is not the primary focus of the play. But I think it's really important to think about how an audience in, you know, the mid-90s would see this play and how we think of this play today. It feels almost historical. It's very much about the Reagan era. There are a lot of political comments about the government at that time. Kushner is very much a liberal and a secular humanist, and that really comes through in the play. But I also think it really touches on themes that are very timely today, about identity, identity politics, how people kind of move through change in the world. And we're, you know, the mid-80s were a time, particularly in that world, in that community, of great flux. I think we're in a time of great flux now. So I think the play can speak to us in a different way, not just as a historical piece of theater.
We're speaking with Lisa Kornetsky from the theater department, the theater faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We are talking about Parkside's newest theatrical production, opening this Friday, Tony Kushner's Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium Approaches. You were telling me, Lisa, before we went on the air that one of your cast members told you yesterday that they had heard or read that you were going to be on the radio to talk about this play, and they asked you, how in the world are you going to do that? Or, I mean, how are you going to talk about this play, and especially how are you going to describe its plot? So what is it?
So you're going to make me do that,
well,
aren't you?
I am afraid I'm going to do that. But ahead of that, what is it about this play or about its plot, maybe with quotes around the word, that make it so hard to describe? Is it not a plot in the conventional sense of the word?
Well, not really. I mean, it is and it isn't. I would say that this play is unlike any other play, any other contemporary play or even modern play. It's epic in scope. It feels Shakespearean to me. But I think it's fairly easy to describe a plot from a Shakespeare play. And this plot has so many different aspects to it and so many layers, and the play does, that it's so rich with so much, it's hard to kind of isolate, you know, what is the play about? You know, we can sum up a lot of plays in a sentence. You know, this is a play about, you know, contemporary relationships. But this is a play that works on multiple levels. It's realistic, but it has fantastical elements in it, supernatural elements, hallucinations. It is very tragic and moving, but it's also very funny in places. Thematically, it has, you know, 8 or 10 different strands that kind of pull it together. So it's like a tapestry, you know, and so in that regard, it's difficult to talk about. But I'm going to try. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is it a chronological plot? I mean, is it at least a standard plot in that sense of the word, that we have events unfolding in time one after another, or is there not?
Yes, no, it is, and it is in that regard a linear play. And it's not that the story is hard to follow, it's just that there are so many pieces to it.
Okay.
Basically, the story follows two different couples. So I'm going to try to do this, and we'll see how I can pull it together. I've been rehearsing this in the car, not very successfully. The first couple is a gay couple, Lewis and Pryor. Well, the play takes place in 1985 in New York City. I just want to set that up. Lewis and Pryor have been together for 4.5 years, and very early on in the play, we learn that Pryor has been diagnosed with AIDS. And as the play moves forward, we learn that Lewis is really struggling with Pryor's illness and decides that as much as he loves Pryor, he cannot stay. So there is that conflict in that relationship.
So in other words, he can't cope
tragedy. And he feels he has to leave to save himself. So that's a big struggle for him, and that goes on through the play. There's also a Mormon couple, Joe and Harper, who are transplants from Salt Lake City who've come to New York City, where Joe has a job as chief clerk for a federal judge. Harper is an agoraphobic. She can't leave the house. She's a Valium addict, and she's terrified of change. Hmm. So she finds a way to sort of cope with her life by hallucinating and traveling to different places. And she has sort of an imaginary character who's a travel agent who takes her to Antarctica. So we have the real world layered with these hallucinations. So these couples kind of parallel each other in their struggle. Joe is a closeted homosexual who is, you know, a religious man, a man with very strong values who's really, really trying very hard to repress what he cannot repress. So there is that struggle. So the two couples have these parallel struggles about staying together or leaving, being true to themselves or focusing on their love. There's just a lot happening. At the same time, we have friends who support, nurses, and we have two historical characters who find their way into the play. Roy Cohn, who some listeners our age may have heard of Roy Cohn, who was a lawyer for Joseph McCarthy during the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings. He was someone who – he actually died of AIDS, although as in the play, he insisted he had liver cancer, as he did in real life. And he was also very involved in the trial of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were convicted of spying in the 50s, selling secrets to the Russians, and were executed in a very controversial trial and execution. So Roy Cohn is a mentor for Joe. He is this larger-than-life representation for Kushner, I think, of the Reagan era and politics during that time. And Ethel Rosenberg comes back to haunt Roy as a character in the play. So we have, you know, realism and fantasy happening at the same time, but all kind of moving us forward in this idea of this cataclysm that is about to come. So throughout the play, as we go on, we get more and more signs that something is about to happen. And Pryor begins to hear a voice, and the voice is the voice of an angel. And eventually, at the end of the play, that angel who has chosen, or heaven has chosen Pryor as a prophet, that angel descends into his, crashes through the ceiling of his room. And that is the way part one ends. Mm. So we're sort of at this very climactic moment. We don't really know what the angel wants, why she's there, but we know that something very strange and important is happening.
Mm. You say that this play, part that is part one, Millennium Approaches, is often done on its own and that it works on its own.
I definitely think it works on its own, although I do think it leaves the audience with a what? as it does for the characters at the end. I mean, it ends on that climactic moment. I think if I were an audience member coming to see this, you know, I would be interested in reading and understanding what happens in part two. And there are lots of ways to do that online. We are actually going to have a staged reading of part two in February for those people who want to see that. And the one thing that I can say is we do have an explanation, which very briefly I can just say that we find that I'm just trying to say this simply, that God has abandoned heaven. Mm. We find that out in part two. And the angels are living in a sort of broken down city like San Francisco after the earthquake, and they are waiting for God to return. And so as they wait, they decide that they need a prophet who will help mankind to stop changing, and that God has left because his creations continue to change and evolve, and he has kind of lost control. So the angels are trying to bring God back by convincing Pryor, that character with AIDS, to in some way instill sort of stasis back into the world. And so the play is very much, part one as well, very much about change versus stasis, that people are on these journeys, that they are either afraid of change or that they are moving towards change. And I think Kushner's point is that that change happens, and it's how we either embrace that change or move forward with that change and how it impacts the values that we have that makes a difference in the world that we live in. And he takes that theme and layers it onto America in the 80s on the verge of the third millennium, and sort of asks us to kind of look at that and see what we see, if that makes any sense at all.
It does. No, it does. On the other hand, as you describe this play, I can imagine if you were teaching a playwriting course and some young aspiring playwright came to you and said, I'd like you to look at this play I've just written, and they handed you something like Angels in America, I mean, that was this long and in a sense this unwieldy, I should think that the typical playwriting instructor would probably
let's
steer them away.
Let's tighten that up. Get rid of that subplot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, in other words, I guess it is astonishing to me that something like this could work as brilliantly as it does. And it seems to me that only a real genius could make something so unwieldy, in fact, be coherent and cohesive and have real impact.
Well, I think part of what happened, there are a couple of things that Kushner talks about in his writing of the play. One is that he worked in partnership with Oscar Eustace, who I believe, I'm getting this right, was the artistic director at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. And that, you know, when you have a great director, a great artistic director who can work with a playwright on shaping it and developing it in workshop, I think that is a really unusual experience. I think most playwrights would welcome, but hard to find. So I think some of it was that partnership. And he also talks about a friend of his, a very close friend of him, a woman who had, and I can't remember what the illness is, I apologize, that she had, but her dealing with her disease and with how her life had been transformed, I think also impacted him. But I think it's true that when we're teaching anything, we sort of look for, you know, this is the way you write a play. This is the, you know, these are the pieces that you have to have. And this is the formula, I'm putting that in quotes. And I think sometimes as teachers, and you're a teacher as well, that we perhaps look for things to fit into that box. And Kushner doesn't fit into a box.
And
thank goodness he doesn't, because he has written, I think, the most brilliant play of the last 25 years, and many critics will agree with that.
I've seen that said time
and
time
over.
Again.
Yeah.
Right. I suppose an operatic parallel would be that only a Wagner, only somebody, a genius of the stature of Wagner, could have successfully created something like the Ring Cycle. And that a lesser composer, a composer with lesser gifts, lesser vision, probably would never think to try such a thing, nor be capable of executing it with the level of excellence that he manages. And in a sense, this is like a Ring Cycle, in a sense.
I think so. I think the other thing, you know, in reading about Kushner is, you know, thinking about what it was to be a gay man living in that community in those years, to see death so prevalent, and such, you know, to, you know, be frank, AIDS deaths are horrible.
Well, and they came so often to the young.
So quickly.
Absolutely.
Or with great suffering. So, you know, thinking about a man like Kushner with his sensibilities and his, you know, political perspective, living through that and thinking, how do I take this, you know, more than a crisis, but this event that has changed the world for him and that community, at least at that time, and plug that into what's happening in the world, and connect that to the spiritual, because Lewis is a Jew, and the play starts with a funeral service for Lewis's grandmother, with a, you know, an old Orthodox rabbi making this incredibly beautiful speech about the journeys that we take. And then we have Mormons, you know, Mormonism being sort of an American religion, a fairly modern religion, and this whole idea of saints, the Latter-day Saints. And he sort of weaves all of this together with speeches about the ozone layer falling apart and all kinds of things happening. So I think some of it, I think he's a great playwright, but I think this play came to this playwright at a time when, you know, all the pieces were there for him to just achieve greatness in this regard.
Incredible. By the way, was this his first play, or was he a relatively inexperienced playwright at this time? Do you happen to know?
This was not his first play, but and I can't pull up out of my memory what his first play was, but this was certainly his first real success. And he's been very successful since then, but again, I think more as a screenwriter than as a playwright in terms of a sort of broad reputation.
Right. In some ways, you wonder if his relative inexperience was a plus in that it's like, in a sense, he didn't know how crazy this was. I mean, he just sort of went for it with probably, in some respects, a sense of abandon.
I think absolutely. And he talks about some of the things that were important to him. You know, he talks about how there's been some – because we just celebrated the 25th anniversary of this play, there have been some recent interviews with him. There's wonderful stuff on the web about this National Theater production and interviews with those actors. But he really talks about trying to understand and click into – what makes a community work and what brings people to community, where people find family. He certainly talks about the complexities of love, but I think ultimately he really is talking about, you know, we look for answers in different places, and we may look for those answers in religion, and we may find many of them there. But if we are not making those deep connections with other human beings, then we are missing something great in our journey. And those characters who can't make those connections are those that don't move forward.
Right. Especially someone like Mr. Cohn in the play, who is depicted at least as a closeted person who cannot come to terms with who he is, and in a sense can't make the same kind of journey that others do.
Right, and a complex man who is very, you know, we get some ideas of what his background is, and, you know, his own sort of self-hatred that's underneath it. But he is the one character, I would say. Kushner has great empathy, I would say, for all of his characters. So even Lewis, who, you know, makes this decision to leave his lover while he's ill, Lewis is one of my favorite characters because he's... We may not like the choice he makes, but I think we really come to understand it and have empathy for that struggle. It's not an easy thing, and it doesn't solve his problem. But Roy Cohn is, in part one, really portrayed as almost two-dimensional, and I think he is a villain for Kushner. But in part two, when he dies and we hear the Kaddish, the Jewish mourner's prayer, which Ethel Rosenberg helps Lewis to give over his body, there is some sense of, even there is forgiveness. And I think forgiveness is an important theme in the play.
Right. We're speaking with Lisa Kornetsky from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside about Tony Kushner's Angels in America, part one, Millennium Approaches, which they are doing. It opens this weekend, and it will run the second weekend in December as well at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. So what did your young cast members make of this play, and what has this process been like of working with them and putting this production together with them?
Well, I will say that, you know, this is, I think I've said before, this is my favorite play. I just love this play from the moment I saw it and then read it, and I've taught it. I think a lot of our students have read it. It's, you know, it's in every anthology of world drama right now. So a lot of the students knew it and were intrigued by the play. When we went into play selection last year, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues, and she was saying to me, Misty Bradford, our costume designer, but what do you really want to do? And I said, well, of course, I'd love to do Angels in America, but, you know, we're not going to do that. And it had been on our lists before and rejected. And she said, why not? I think we should do it. And the faculty all sort of looked at each other and said, let's do it. It's a great play. It's a great experience for, you know, we do Shakespeare, and we don't shy away from that. This is such an important play, and yes, they're young, and you know, some of them are, you know, all of them are inexperienced in that regard, and the play is perhaps, if we look at the scheme of things, far more difficult than almost anything else we could choose. But isn't that a perfect educational experience? Mm. And great for our audiences. It's a challenging play on every level.
Right. Can I just ask, is this a play that is important but not necessarily done all that often? I mean, at least at this level. I mean, I don't remember other colleges and universities that I've heard of at least doing this. I mean, is it uncommon?
I think it's fairly uncommon to be done in universities because it's not only is it challenging – and it's challenging technically, but it is it has sexual content. It has a lot of language. You know, I would call it R-rated. That's how we're kind of billing it. And so I think there are, you know, people might shy away from, you know, audiences are going to complain. People aren't going to like this. You know, it has a particular political perspective. And it's just plain hard. but regional theaters in the late 90s, early 2000s were doing a lot. It was done at the Milwaukee Chamber Theater, at the Milwaukee Rep. And again, it's coming around to Broadway. So I think it's a play that, you know, has gone through a cycle. It is a little bit of a risk for us. But, you know, my feeling is that theater should challenge audiences. And, you know, it's great to have things that are really entertaining and people come and they laugh and they have a great time. But I think every once in a while we owe our audiences the challenge of really experiencing something that is going to be, it might challenge their values, it might be uncomfortable in some ways, but it's also hopefully going to get people to think in some new and different ways. In terms of our student actors, I have a great cast. I have been so impressed because the material is so difficult. So there are five male actors, and all of them are playing gay men at different stages in their understanding of that, their knowledge of that, their being out or not out, their age. And, you know, these are young actors. And, you know, they have worked very hard to be you know, to not be offensive, but to take on those roles. They've been very brave in the ways that they've done that. And they've not shied away from the language, from the material. We've cut one scene that we felt was too graphic for our audience. But other than that, you know, we've kept everything that's there. And it's a 3-hour play, so the audience should know that. With, you know, two intermissions, it's a lot to learn. It's a lot to understand with all of that complexity. And we had a 4-week rehearsal period with kind of 2 weeks of tech because of Thanksgiving holiday, which is a week shorter than we would normally rehearse for a much shorter, less complicated play.
Wow.
So the process has been incredibly intense, long nights. But they're doing a great job. And I do want to add that all of the designers for this production are students. And the play has some, you know, some pretty complex technical moments. And these designers have worked very hard to collaborate together, to come up with ideas that we can accomplish within our budget and within our time frame. So it's been it's been an intense process. It's been a good process, but we've had some jigs and jags along the way. And that's the best kind of learning for our students, right? Mm. To take on something that is not simple.
Right, to say the least.
To say the least, yeah.
What kind of conversations have you had about this play, about these themes, about the reality of AIDS, for instance, and that sort of thing? What kind of a journey of discovery and learning has it been for these young people in that respect?
Well, I started over the – we cast this play in May before the semester ended last year. So the actors had the summer to be working on their roles. And over the summer, I sent people – links to things. I sent people suggestions of videos that they might watch, particularly about AIDS. And we have a wonderful dramaturg, a student dramaturg, who at the first rehearsal presented the actors with a packet with information on AIDS, the Rosenbergs, who's Roy Cohn, what is Mormonism, you know, all of those things. I'm Jewish, so I sort of provided that that learning because we, you know, we don't have any Jewish or Mormon students in the cast. And then we spent two very long rehearsals talking about the themes, doing the book work. And I did bring in a couple of clips from films that I thought would help students to understand who Roy Cohn was and Ethel Rosenberg, but also what AIDS was like in the 80s. Hmm. So some documentaries, one was someone talking about, you know, a survivor talking about his experience in the 80s, and another which was a film that followed a couple as they went through their disease and their death, and I showed them some, and this was actually a professor of mine from college who was a filmmaker who had one of his students make this documentary about this couple. And I showed them some clips that were pretty brutal for them to watch, and I think that was like, okay, now I get it. You know, they saw – it's one thing to talk about a Kaposi's lesion. Mm. It's another thing to see someone covered with them. Mm. And so really having them understand the power of that and the pain of that. And then we just, you know, we spend a lot of time through the rehearsal process talking about the historical relevance, but also, you know, the things you do in any play. What do these characters want, and how are they going about trying to get what they want? You know, all of the things that actors need to do to make something real and believable for themselves and the audience.
Mm. I hope this isn't too personal a question, and just say it is if it is. I wonder for your cast, if in any way, for some of them, was this a more personal experience than it might otherwise be in terms of who they are and how this spoke to the lives they live?
I think maybe a little bit. If we look at the whole team, the production team, we have understudies who are actually work as an ensemble to move things around. It's a large group of people. Certainly, I think there are aspects of the play, and let's be frank, people in these are traditional age students who are coming into their own and figuring out who they are.
Right.
And whether it's about sexuality or anything else, this is a time when people are struggling with all kinds of identities. And so
right.
I think in that regard, everybody was impacted by that. I was able to talk about my experiences and just living through that time. We brought in some alums from Milwaukee, one of whom works at the LGBTQ Center in Milwaukee. Gay men who talked about, there are elements of drag in the play. You know, they just sort of came in. They talked about friendships and community and how, their understanding as men approaching 30 with people they know who lived through that time period. And the actors were really interested in asking questions and delving in. And I'm sure that some of them, in ways that they didn't discuss with me, were just challenged to think about themselves in multiple ways. And
right.
Hopefully that's what actors do in any role that they're playing.
Of course, absolutely. But I can see how this particular play could also be a very fertile ground for that kind of exploration.
Absolutely.
What is your advice for people who are contemplating coming to see this? I think you've done a really amazing job of at least capsulizing a bit sort of what the play is about and so on, and what it's like to experience it, its length, the R rating you're giving it, and so on. Aside from knowing all of that, otherwise, what would you say to someone who is pondering coming to this play?
Well, I certainly think we live in a world very different than that of 1985, where we can Google anything and get a good sense of what that experience might be. So I think if people are contemplating that, Google Angels in America and read about the production that is about to open in New York. There is a wonderful review by Frank Rich in the New York Times from 1993, when the play opened, where he does a wonderful job of talking about the play. I think, you know, my best advice would be, if you want to be intrigued and you are willing to just be in the room with us, I mean, we're in our black box theater, so it's an intimate setting. Be open. Have a cup of coffee before you come. Be prepared to enjoy and laugh. I mean, there's a lot in it that is very funny and strange. And I think it's a journey. The whole thing is a journey, so be willing to take that journey. We also we have a wonderful a student who has been documenting our process through photography and video. And some of that is available through our website. There's also an audience guide on our website on the ticket page. So if people just go to www.uwp.edu and click on Theater Arts or our box office, go to that page, you can read the audience guide. And we're going to have a whole room of a display about all kinds of things, AIDS, the Rosenbergs, Roy Cohn, all kinds of things that before the show and during intermission will hopefully help people to sort of understand some of those connections. But I don't think you need to know anything to be able to sit there and watch the journey of these characters and understand the play. I think any great play, there are layers and layers and layers, and we don't get all of it at all at once. And this play will leave people questioning at the end. But I kind of think that's okay, you know? Life is complicated, right? Things don't always wrap up neatly.
On that note, then, we want to remind everyone that Angels in America by Tony Kushner opens this Friday. It runs this weekend and the following weekend in the Black Box Theater in the Rita at the University of Wisconsin.
It's a 7. We've changed our starting times for everything in the Rita. So it's a 7 p.m. as opposed to 7:30. So we just want people to know that it's starting early, but that is good for a three-hour play to start, start early.
I couldn't agree more. If people are interested in attending Angels in America, what are they supposed to do?
Well, again, if for more information, you can go to our website, the Parkside website. You can also call 262-595-2564, or you can order tickets online at uwparksidetickets.com. There is a lot of information on our website. I really encourage people to see to check that out. And I, just really quickly, I want to say 3 hours is a long time, but it doesn't feel like 3 hours. So, you know, I don't want to discourage people from the length, but I do want to make people aware of that.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. But it's absolutely true that something really good. I mean, I was just talking to your colleague, Jim Kinchin, yesterday on the morning show. They are doing The Complete Messiah, which is a very long, in fact, comparable to Angels in America in length. But it's such a great work.
Right.
And when you do it all, somehow, in some miraculous way, it ends up not feeling as long as if you chopped it up and just, you know, did little bits of it.
Right.
As a whole, it just flows seamlessly. And I suspect this play is very much the same kind of thing.
I hope so. I think it is, yes. Hmm.
Well, Lisa Kornetsky, once again, it's been such a great pleasure to talk with you and to hear about this really remarkable play, an important work for audiences and for actors and others who are part of this production to be able to experience. And I really appreciate you taking the time during what I'm sure is a crushingly challenging week to come in early and speak about it on the morning
show. Well, I always love to come here. It's one of my favorite things to do. So thank you for letting me join you.
Well, great to have you here. Lisa Kornetsky from the Theater Arts Department at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And again, Tony Kushner's Angels in America opens this weekend at the Rita in their Black Box Theater. Tomorrow on the morning show, I speak with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Peter Dene, from the music faculty, and with him will be composer Jocelyn Hagen. And Jocelyn Hagen, a very well-known choral composer, has been commissioned to compose a piece which will be a mass choir finale to Carthage's Christmas Festival, which is this weekend. And Jocelyn Hagen will be with Dr. Dene to talk about this commissioned work and about some of the other things that she has done during her very long and impressive career. So that's tomorrow on the morning show. And on Friday, I will be speaking to the author of a new book called Cutting School, which explores some of the moves towards privatization that